Well, thank you very much, Tanya, for your introduction. I think this is the eighth year we've been doing these lunches, and this is the largest audience we've had. So I figure you're here for the jokes, really. Note to Bloomberg, that was humour. I want to thank Stephen Halmarik and the Australian Business Economist for the support that they give us each year in organising this function. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks, Stephen. I want to thank also Macquarie Securities Group, Tanya, and others that are here. On behalf of them, thank you for your financial support. There is actually a free lunch. It's provided by Macquarie today, and all the money that you've paid for your ticket will go to the foundation. Thanks also to Dan for coming along. It's been incredibly exciting for the board of the foundation to support you and to see the work that you've put into making the lives of our kids safer. So thank you, Dan, for coming along, and our best wishes for your future work. Thanks all of you for coming along today to support the foundation. This is one of our key fundraising initiatives each year, and I very much appreciate you coming along. Well, we've been living interesting times for the past 5 years or more. The shocks to which the economy has been subject have had larger magnitudes than had been the case during the earlier period, the so-called Great Moderation. The world economy, our terms of trade, the international availability of credit and so on, have all been more variable than they had been. The variability of world GDP has approximately doubled in the past 5 years compared to the decade prior to 2007. The volatility of our terms of trade on some metrics has quadrupled over that same period. In response to that, our interest rates and the exchange rate have also been more variable. The point of all that, of course, was to help the economy adapt, and there hasn't, as it turns out, been much additional variation in real GDP or the unemployment rate over these past 5 years. Depending on your preferred measure, variability of real GDP has gone up a little bit or down a little bit, and there's a similar story for the unemployment rate. There was, of course, a pronounced cycle in inflation, which rose very steeply there in 2008, but since then, it's been much better behaved. So this suggests that the various policy responses and the economy's own adjustment capacity have generally been working as they should to help stabilise overall outcomes in the face of the larger shocks that we've faced, mainly from abroad. Having said that, achieving the sort of growth rates to which we aspire is getting harder. The average output growth in these past 5 years has been lower than it had been in the preceding decade. And that's been true also in just about every other advanced country. Moreover, the challenges ahead are substantial and they will require appropriate responses. In shaping those responses, we need to be sure that we draw the right conclusions and lessons from the experiences of recent years. In that vein, as I offer some remarks about the period ahead, I also want to draw on those conclusions. And in so doing, I'm going to be reiterating some themes that I've touched on before, including at earlier lunches in this series. It's now well understood that the mining boom, so-called, is shifting gear and that we're entering a new phase. Now, you'll recall that the story of this boom has always had three phases. In the first phase, commodity prices rose to very high levels, and as a result, Australia's terms of trade rose to levels not seen in a very long time. Those prices had something of a hiatus in 2008 and 9 with the global downturn, but very quickly resumed their upward trend and indeed reached new peaks. In historical context, these high prices have been quite persistent. One metric for that is that if you compute a 10-year moving average of the terms of trade, and if you allow for some further significant falls over the next few years, you'll still find that the 10-year moving average reached a point 50% higher than the average for the 20th century. So it's been quite persistent. And that persistence led to the second phase, in which resource producers ramped up their investment to take advantage of demand for raw materials, and in particular iron ore, natural gas, and to a lesser extent coal. Resource investment rose from about 2% of GDP, where it had spent the past 50 years, to peak at about 8%. That big rise is now over, it would appear, and a fall is in prospect with uncertain timing. In due course, it could be quite a big fall. The third phase is now underway, in which we will see that investment spending fall back, but we will see a lift in volume shipped of the various commodities. That's already started. Iron ore volumes, for example, are rising at 15% per year. But shipments will probably increase a good deal further yet and then stay high. Shipments of natural gas will not start increasing strongly for another couple of years. Then they'll probably have several very strong years of growth and then remain high for some decades. In that third phase, real GDP will get a lift. National income, measured in current dollars, will also get a lift from the higher volumes, though that is likely to be offset in part, at least, by lower prices. The lift in real GDP coming from this rise in exports will be driven more by higher output per person. In fact, the level of employment needed to ship the materials and extract them will be less than the level needed to build the capacity to do that. Let's be clear that Australians will continue to benefit from the higher level of resources output for a long time. Fundamentally, there's been a large lift in the global demand for natural resources that our country happens to have in abundance. Most people agree that the rate of growth of that demand will be lower in the future than it's been in recent years. Some people say much lower. But the lift in the level of demand that we've already seen is permanent enough and large enough to have quite a persistent effect on our economy. The fact is, Australian production is meeting much of the additional global demand for iron ore and, prospectively, natural gas. That will be at prices that, although lower than we see today, perhaps, are nonetheless likely to be higher than the average seen for many years up until the middle of last decade. Even allowing for the high extent of foreign ownership in the resources sector, flows of income accruing to Australians through several channels will be quite high over quite a long period. The end of the second phase, that is the investment phase of the boom, is nonetheless quite a challenging time. The investment spending by the resources sector will no longer be adding to growth in demand in Australia. In due course, it will instead be subtracting from it. Now, to be sure, a significant part of the demand we've seen was met by imports, and so to that extent its decline will therefore affect imports rather than domestic production. But even allowing for that, there's still been some substantial demand for Australian product and labour from the resources sector over recent years, and that appears likely to abate over the years ahead. Since we wish to see aggregate demand in the economy sufficient to utilise all our productive resources of labour and capital, that means that we'd like to see a rotation, so-called, of demand to other areas as the demand from the resources sector slows. So the post-boom story of the economy desirably involves stronger expansion in some other sectors, including those that have seen weaker than normal conditions in recent years. It's reasonable to expect that there will be some pickup in these other areas for reasons that I've outlined in other talks. In brief, business capital spending outside the resources sector has been quite subdued. Housing investment likewise has been low. There's ample scope for both of those to rise over the next several years. That's by no means a certainty, though, and while there are signs of an increase in dwelling investment getting underway, a stronger trend in non-resources business investment looks like it's a little while off yet. For a benign outcome to occur here, a few things need to be in place. Reasonable global growth outcomes obviously would be a major help. At this stage, global growth is subpar, though hardly disastrous, with most forecasters saying that next year we'll see an improvement. They then quickly add a long list of things that could go wrong. Most of those things haven't gone wrong yet, but the list is still there and it's still long. Well, really, there's nothing much we can do about that. The second condition, which we can do something about, is for macroeconomic policy settings to be appropriate. Fiscal policy is in consolidation mode, and that seems broadly appropriate at this point. Monetary policy is, by historical metrics at least, very accommodative. The exchange rate has also declined since its recent highs, and I think doubts about whether it will play its normal role as a shock absorber have lessened of late. A third condition is that Australian businesses need to be internationally competitive, and the exchange rate is helping here, of course, but productivity and cost performance also will be key. On those fronts, my sense is that businesses have stepped up their efforts quite considerably over the past year or two. Well, that combination of things is a necessary, though not in itself sufficient, condition for the sort of demand rotation in the economy that we will need to see. The fourth ingredient is confidence. Here it's somewhat concerning, I think, that the business community's confidence has been quite subdued in recent times. To the extent, of course, that structural change has been occurring, that's always difficult. To the extent there's inevitably uncertainty about the international outlook, it's understandable that business segments, at least some in some cases, have found the going difficult and they don't feel very confident. Moreover, the phase shift of the mining boom itself that we're now seeing is itself dampening confidence in some areas. That said, it would be good, I think, if there was a bit more confidence in the business community about the future. Unfortunately, it's not a straightforward thing to turn this confidence around. There's no business confidence policy lever that somebody can just get hold of and pull. Rather, I think we have to rely on a few more basic things. We have to rely on clarity of policy frameworks and objectives. We have to rely on consistent application of policies within those frameworks and towards well-understood goals. We have to give attention to avoiding things, so far as we can, that would unnecessarily dampen confidence. All the more reason, then, to make sure that the accretion of regulatory actions being undertaken does not inadvertently make it harder for businesses to plan with confidence, to achieve better cost and productivity performance, or to take a chance on a new product, a new investment, or a new worker. Turning to households, in this case, according to surveys, sentiment is neither particularly weak nor particularly strong right now. I think it's reasonable to expect that households will play a role in driving demand over the years ahead, and in due course that will be one of the things that helps to lift business confidence. But in thinking about the role of households, we need to understand the ways in which household behaviour has changed. And the title of the talk, Policy After the Booms, plural, that's quite deliberate, because there were two booms. Before there was the mining boom, or at least before its full flowering in the past 6 or 7 years, there was another boom. It was a global boom but it was one in which Australians took part. I'm referring, of course, to the boom in credit, which saw a very significant increase in borrowing by households in particular, and a rise in asset values, especially dwellings. And that was associated with a lengthy period of unusually strong growth in consumption. That boom didn't end in Australia as painfully as it did in some other places, but it did end. And so I want to go back to some charts I showed at this lunch 2 years ago in 2011 and show you the updated charts. There are also some revisions to some of this data, particularly on the wealth series, which are set out in a footnote in the printed version of the talk. The first chart here shows even more clearly than it did 2 years ago the way in which behaviour of household consumption has shifted. Remember, these are measures of real consumption and income per person over, and that's a logarithmic scale, over a period of about 18 years. Real consumption per person had risen faster than real income per person for 30 years, from the mid-1970s up until about 2005. We've only got the last third of that period on that chart. But if you draw this chart further back, that's the story. That behaviour changed some years ago, obviously, and after a noticeable fall in consumption around the outbreak of the global downturn in late 2008, spending and income have thereafter grown on roughly parallel tracks. Saving rate hasn't changed a great deal. That's quite a profound change. One of the contributing factors is shown here, where it's clear why people's sense of wealth has not been rising at anything like the rate at which it had been. Financial assets have begun in the green have begun to grow again. The share market has recovered some ground. People have accumulated financial assets, including quite a lot in the way of deposits. But the value of non-financial assets, which is largely dwellings, is lower today in real per capita terms than it was 5 years ago. Total assets per person in real terms have risen at about 2.5% per year since the middle of 2009. That's much slower than in the preceding decade and even a bit slower than in the period from 1975 to 94. The slowdown in asset values has been associated with a lift in saving and a slower path, as you saw, for consumption, and that's had important implications for the economy. Let me try to just illustrate that in one other way. This is a table that shows contributions to growth in demand and output from the national accounts from over two periods, from the mid-90s up to 2007 and then from 2007 on. Now, these don't actually add exactly because of the chain-length nature of the series these days. They don't quite precisely add up. So it's not a complete accounting of contributions in that sense, but I think it's pretty illustrative of the fact that the slowdown in consumption has been a major factor. The consumption growth rate, 1.4%, that's a lot lower than the previous 2.3% and a good deal lower if we went back to the earlier chart. We had 2.8% there for quite a long time up to 2005. So that's quite a big change. Your assessment of the prospects for consumption will be driven by mainly two things, largely income growth, obviously, and it will also be affected by expectations about asset values, and I think particularly one's view about whether housing prices are overvalued. Those who think they are will likely be drawn to the conclusion that a number of more years of flat or declining real per capita asset values, at least for non-financial assets, could easily lie ahead. Those who are not so worried about housing prices being overvalued might expect stronger growth than that will occur. But either way, it seems unlikely that we could bank on a return to sustained growth in assets in real per person terms of 6 or 7% over the years ahead. That is, in my opinion, highly likely to occur on any sustainable basis. It follows that the saving rate is unlikely, I think, anytime soon to decline back to where it was before this recent adjustment, back to where it was in the mid-2000s. Average saving rates, much more like what we have now, seem to me to be much more likely. There will be cyclical ups and downs, but I suspect the average will be higher. It's commonly said that the current rate of saving is high. Actually, if you look back through the data, I think normal is a much more accurate description. What are the implications that flow from that? Well, there are a number, but let me set out just a few. Firstly, and most evidently, some strengthening in consumption growth from the rather subdued pace we've seen just recently is a reasonable expectation, but we shouldn't expect a return to that earlier very strong trend rate of growth. Nor, surely, should we try to engineer one, at least not on the back of borrowing. Households at this point certainly are servicing their debts well. If anything, arrears rates have gone down over the past year. But we would be risking, I think, future problems if we were to see a big run-up in debt from its current position. That doesn't preclude prudent levels of borrowing by, say, new entrants into the housing market or by investors. It doesn't preclude real gains in consumption as costs are squeezed out of the system, which I think is happening. It doesn't mean that consumers won't respond with their customary alacrity to new products which are offered at attractive prices. Presumably many of the trend changes in habits that we're seeing, like more online shopping, more consumption of services and experiences as opposed to stuff, that probably will continue. And factors that could lift disposable income, like higher real earnings on the back of productivity growth or sustainable reductions in taxes, all of those could be expected to lift consumption on a sustainable basis. But we're unlikely, I think, to see a return to the earlier boom conditions. The second implication of all this is that other things equal, interest rates are likely to be lower in such a world, and indeed they already are, than they were in a world in which households were in the process of extending their finances and gearing up their balance sheets. That's a global phenomenon, but it holds in Australia too. A desired rate of higher rate of saving ex ante means that the return to saving, other things equal, is going to be lower as the market clears. Now, those who've been long-term savers no doubt feel aggrieved, and I can tell you they do. They write to me that the returns they have already enjoyed in the past, the earlier returns, can't be found as easily now. And the reason for that is that lots of other people have joined them in wanting to save, and the market prices reflect that. That said, it is still possible to earn a pre-tax, at least, interest rate on a bank deposit that's a bit above the inflation rate. A third implication is that a desire to hold any given amount of saving in a less risky form means that the yield give up that you experience to get that safety has increased. The way we usually express this is that risk spreads have risen. Lower risk appetite, or perhaps more accurately, clearer perception of risk that was always there, means that risk spreads are higher. They're well down on their peaks from the peak of the crisis, but they've settled, it would appear, at levels generally higher than, at least in this country, than used to be the case prior to the crisis. Absolute borrowing costs, of course, for most borrowers are very low, despite these higher spreads, because the return on one of the least risky assets, namely the cash rate, is the lowest for 50 years or more. Market yields on government securities, the lowest risk asset of all, have likewise been very low, including in Australia. So in other words, with many investors wanting safety, the price of safety has gone up. In fact, it has to rise, or that is, the yield for safety has to fall, by enough to prompt at least some people to start to shift their portfolios in the direction of taking some more risk. by holding equities or real assets or whatever the case may be. Obviously, we don't want too much risk-taking, but we do want some more prudent risk-taking going on. And one of the things we've been watching for as we've been lowering interest rates has been for an indication of savers starting to shift their portfolios in that way. And that has been happening. It's one of the expected and intended effects of monetary policy easing. There are, as I say, clearly signs of policy working in this respect, though not, at least to date, by so much that we see a serious impediment to further easing, were that to be appropriate from an overall macroeconomic point of view. So in the third phase of the mining boom and post the credit boom, our economic challenges are changing. In the next few years, our task will involve supporting, so far as it's in our power, a change in the sources of demand that affect the economy. As resources sector investment declines, other sources of demand need to strengthen, but they need to do it in a way that's sustainable. The fact that consumption is likely to provide only a modest impetus to any acceleration in domestic demand suggests that other areas will be important. As I noted earlier, at least some of the conditions are in place for stronger trends in dwelling investment and in time for non-resources business capital spending. And, of course, exports of resources themselves will continue to pick up quite strongly, and so those are all sources of demand. But successful rotation, so-called, of demand will probably also involve more net foreign demand for other Australian output of various kinds. Given that, the recent decline in the exchange rate seems to make sense from an overall macroeconomic perspective. It would not be a major surprise if a further decline occurred over time, though, of course, events elsewhere in the world also will have a bearing on that particular relative price. The conduct of monetary policy must and does take account of the various features of the environment that we face. Calibrations that we might draw from an earlier period of history can't be assumed to have the same reliability. Elements of the monetary policy transmission process are probably also working somewhat differently than on other occasions. To take just one example, the fact that policies in other major economies have been so unusual at such extreme settings for so long obviously has had implications for the exchange rate. So that matters in what we do here, though, as I noted earlier, the exchange rate appears to have been behaving more normally of late. The fact that the rest of the world has had such low rates, that the desire for safe assets has been so strong, that the spreads between the cash rate and the rates that matter most for the economy have widened, and that people have sought to get to a position of lower leverage, all these have been important in why the cash rate's been so low in recent years compared with what we had been used to up until not so many years ago. That has occurred while we've had the peak of the resources boom, the biggest thing of its kind in 100 years, is all the more remarkable. That setting has been guided by the flexible inflation targeting framework that we've had in place for about 20 years now. That framework has prompted appropriate and timely action when needed. It's prompted a substantial easing of policy since late 2011. We've been saying recently that the inflation outlook may afford, I'll get these words exactly right, may afford some scope to ease policy further if needed to support demand. That's what we've been saying in the statements and the minutes. The recent inflation data do not appear to have shifted that assessment. More generally, the credible and sensible approach to policies is fairly straightforward things: to keep our eyes on the main objectives, to preserve and articulate sound frameworks, to act consistently with those frameworks and in ways that support confidence, and to keep looking for ways to enhance the flexibility the economy itself has demonstrated in adjusting to the shocks of recent years. Failure to do that would be costly, but the rewards from consistent application of good policies are known from our own experience to be big, even if they are not immediate. Remembering that is the challenge that we face. So thank you very much again for coming along and supporting the UNECA Foundation today. And I'm happy to have a go at some questions. Thank you.
Matthew Johnson, UBS. Governor Stevens, you mentioned a weaker currency as being a part of the adjustment process. Under what circumstances could the RBA afford to look through the inflation caused by a falling Australian dollar?
Well, Matt, I think swings in the exchange rate, we've had some quite big ones in recent years, and I think it's unlikely that they're going to derail us seriously on inflation. I think the framework has A, sufficient flexibility, and B, sufficient credibility that I don't think we'll have too many dramas on that front, short of a very, very large depreciation, which, of course, we haven't yet seen.
Brian Redican from Macquarie. Governor, you spoke about the third phase of the commodity price boom, and we've seen a doubling of the capital stock over the last 10 years. As those exports come on stream, does that actually mean that Australia's potential growth rate has potentially shifted up a gear, so we could potentially grow at something like 3.5%?
Interesting question. Obviously, the potential growth rate or the potential level of output in the resources sector has to be higher, and we will see that potential used, I'm sure, over the years ahead. The question will be at what price that potential is used. In the rest of the economy, I guess it comes back to, you know, if we're going to have a bigger resources sector, we're having some smaller other sectors, and we've got to reallocate some of that capital and labour, so it's more of a mixed picture for them. But I think for the moment, without wanting to make numbers up on the run, we haven't changed our view noticeably on the sorts of things we'd think about as the potential pace of growth, apart from the obvious fact that there'll be a step up in the level of resource exports as that capacity gets used. Bill?
Governor, let me predicate this by saying I'm definitely not looking for a forecast here. But in a very important speech, Deputy Governor Lowe spoke to the Australian Business Economists in December last year, and he was talking about the low interest rate environment, and he said that he thought that monetary policy would work all the way down to a cash rate of 1%. Would you be able to share with us your own views on this and whether there are any institutional aspects of the Australian economy that might limit the impact of monetary policy at very, very low rates of interest?
Well, there might be, but I don't think we're there. I would think that from the point of view of lower bounds and so on, I don't think those things are going to impair us in the likely scenarios we face. The fact that people have, at least in some cases, a genuine desire to get leverage down, I think has affected the way the economy responds to interest rates, but that won't be a permanent feature. That's a feature of this phase that we take on board. So I'm not especially concerned right now by, you know, kind of running out of ammunition in the near term, if that's your question, which that's my interpretation of the question anyway. Thank you. Philip?
Phil Lasker from the ABC. Glenn, always enjoy your humour. It makes good news stories, no doubt about that. You talked about confidence in your speech, and you talked about there was no such thing as a confidence policy lever. Rather, we have to rely on clarity of policy frameworks and objectives, consistent application of policy towards well-understood goals, and attention to avoiding things that can dampen confidence unnecessarily. Has the government been falling down in that area?
Unsurprisingly, I'm not going to make particular comments, Phil, on things that governments do. Excuse me. I'm simply making the point that I think consistency, clarity, care, these are all important. This is the way that we are seeking to do our job, and I think that's a good set of principles, and I would be very surprised if the government didn't agree with that, actually. Thank you. Rory.
Governor Stevens, Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury. Thanks for another fascinating talk on the nature of our present discontents. I will actually press you on forecasts in that in the past week there have been several apparently well-sourced and credible reports in the media that the Reserve Bank on Friday week will announce a marking down of its growth forecasts. In some of those reports, there also has been a discussion that the Reserve Bank would be pleased if the Australian dollar fell into the mid 80s range. I wonder if you
really?
Could comment on whether those. I wonder if you could comment on whether those reports are actually well sourced and credible.
I don't know who the purported source is. It's not me. I'm not going to foreshadow what will happen to the forecasts when they're released on Friday week. Obviously, the staff are busy, taking on board all the recent information. You've all got that information, so you can probably make a reasonable guess of which way, if any, the forecast might move. The thing I have said today is that the comment we've made earlier about the inflation outlook as we presently assessed it may provide some scope, etc. I'm saying that the recent data haven't changed that, but that's as close as I'm going to forecasts today. On the exchange rate, I think your view here really hinges on, not entirely, but to a considerable extent, on what you think will happen to resource prices over time. The main thing we know about the exchange rate in its historical behaviour is that it's had this quite strong association with the terms of trade. That's an association which the market has thrown up. If you think the terms of trade will fall further, which is what most people think, then it would be kind of surprising if the exchange rate did not respond to that at some point. But when that happens, and whether it's to the mid-80s or some other number, it really depends on what your view is about those other fundamental forces. As always with exchange rates, what it means, where it's going, depends on why it's moving. So my main comment there is, you can't just make an exchange rate forecast in isolation. It's part of a whole system, and those other parts of the equation need to be spelled out as well. And back to this side.
Hi, Governor. John Keogh from the Australian Financial Review. If interest rates fall to a level, or even indeed if they're at a level now where inflation remains benign but asset prices start to rise maybe too aggressively, to what extent would the Reserve Bank or indeed APRA have to consider macroprudential tools to sort of keep those asset prices in check?
I don't think that's a problem we as yet face, John. If we did, then I personally am not averse to consideration of macroprudential tools, and I don't speak for APRA, of course, and the tools that would need to be deployed are really within their powers, not ours. But if that needed to be considered, then it would be considered. Right now, I don't think we've reached that point.
Adam Donaldson, Commonwealth Bank. You spoke in your talk about recalibration of certain old relationships and also, of course, about deleveraging and the fact that we're no longer in a a 30-year credit boom. In that period, the Reserve Bank used to refer to the neutral rate of interest in real terms being perhaps 3 to 3.5%. I'm wondering, in this recalibrated world, if that number's now lower and where perhaps it might lie.
Well, I think the Deputy Governor, it might have been even in the speech that Bill referred to, or possibly another one, had some comments about what is normal now. And as I recall, there was some consideration of the possibility that what we might call normal or neutral is lower than it used to be. One obvious reason for that is that spreads are higher, so the cash rate that delivers even normal borrowing rates is probably 100 points lower than it used to be, as we've said many times before. And some of the factors I've referred to today, I think, do carry the implication that some notion of normal or neutral, at least for a time, could well be a bit lower than it used to be. By how much, I can't tell you the answer to that, because I don't think that's... It's not amenable to direct observation. It would only... sort of emerge out of experience, really. So I don't think ex ante one can say with any precision at all it's lower by, you know, some quantum. Rob.
Rob Henderson, National Australia Bank Governor. My question's about China, and I put it in the context of I know that the Reserve Bank has beefed up its capacity to analyse China substantially over the past few years. So, I mean, I was interested in the last set of minutes that I think you described the situation in the Chinese economy as growth steady, stable investment. So it sounded, you know, fairly not positive, but neither negative about China. And since then we've had, I think, some, you know, disappointing numbers coming out of China. So in the context of, you know, this readjustment for Australia, I'm wondering about, you know, I'd agree with you that a 7% China still means a lot of export volumes, but if China's softer and commodity prices are still falling, nominal GDP is going to be a fair bit weaker, and that might cause more problems for our economy. So I'm wondering to what extent the, you know, Reserve Bank is concerned about, you know, the apparent sort of ongoing soft set of data and the readjustment that's going on in China at the moment, Governor.
Well, I mean, you describe the data as disappointing. I suppose, you know, there have been one or two soft indicators, but really, in the broad, it strikes me that the Chinese economy, roughly speaking, is delivering what their policymakers said they wanted, which is we don't want to grow at 10 anymore. We want to grow at, you know, 7 point something, or maybe it's 7.0. And in due course, that will be lower in the very long run thinking that we do from time to time. Over time, you know, 10 years from now, the Chinese growth rate's not going to be 7, it's going to be 6 or 5 or something like that as they get larger. But I myself think that some of the disappointment that people feel about China might be a reflection that they just had numbers that were unrealistically large penciled in. A lot of people had growth of over 8% when the Chinese policymakers were saying, actually, what we want is 7 point something. So I think we're all still kind of, you know, adjusting our expectations there. I think the really important issues in China really lay around whether they can manage the build-up of exposures in the shadow banking system that have occurred. I think they've got ample tools to do that. I think they've got a good understanding of the issues, but it's a difficult task to finesse that and bring it all back to earth gently. That I think is probably, you know, the key question mark to ask about China, rather than whether, you know, industrial production slowed a tad more than we might have thought.
One more.
Governor, Governor Stevens, Su Lin Ong from RBC Capital Markets. I'm just interested in your thoughts on the labour market. The unemployment rate's ticked up a bit of late, and I'm just wondering if it's moved a bit faster than you thought, and generally if your business liaison's giving you any more clues in this area.
I think where we've got to, it's been rising. We've had a year of below-trend growth. The unemployment rate's gone up a bit. That all kind of adds up. I don't have the impression that it's materially exceeded the forecast that we had some months back at this point, but it does appear to still be trending up. And the forward indicators, vacancies and so on, still look quite soft. So that would be my description of the labour market. I think that is the description we've given in the published material up to now, and of course we'll have an update in 10 days.